Hey y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. Hey folks, Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org. All right, y'all, we're going back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest on the show is Adam Morrow. He's a reporter for Interpress Service News Agency. That's ipsnews.net. ipsnews.net. He writes with Khaled Musa Al-Amrani. Ooh, I still haven't spoken to him. I should talk to him sometime. But anyway, Adam is on the phone joining us live again from Cairo. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Good, good, Scott. Glad to be back. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. First of all, your latest article is called Gaza Assault Shows a New Egypt. And this is, of course, very important and I know has been your specialty and your focus over the last, almost 2 years now. The new foreign policy of the new post-Arab Spring Egypt. So that, of course, is extremely important. But we have to start the show today, of course, with the news about the president of Egypt, the new president of Egypt, Morsi, of the Muslim Brotherhood, and his extraordinary power grab, at least according to Western media. I was wondering if you could tell us what the hell's going on.
Just the way you phrased the question, actually, is very indicative. This idea that the way this is being portrayed in the Western media is this sort of naked power grab where Morsi woke up one morning and decided that he wanted to vastly increase his powers at the expense of his political opponents. And there's far more to the story than that sort of simple reading of events. You know, Morsi had his reasons for doing what he did, which, you know, you sort of have to look back at Egypt's recent history in order to understand, Egypt's post-revolution history over the course of the last 18 months. And basically, I mean, his primary reason for doing this is because you have this judiciary that still has many elements of the ousted Mubarak regime in it that have worked tirelessly to sort of undo any of the major changes that he does. For example, just days before the presidential runoff, if you remember that this summer between Mohamed Morsi and Ahmed Shafit, just days before that, the ruling military council ordered the dissolution of the lower house of the People's Assembly, the lower house of Egypt's parliament, the People's Assembly, which had been largely taken by Islamist parties, mostly the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party. Now, they did that. They dissolved the assembly based on a ruling by the Supreme Constitutional Court here. And that that decision basically undid, you know, Egypt's first first post-Mubarak parliamentary elections. And talk is that the same court is basically planning to do the same thing, aims to do the same thing to the upper house of parliament, which is also held largely by Islamists, and the constituent assembly, which is tasked with writing a new constitution. So the reason Morsi did this basically is in order to protect these elected institutions from dissolution by this judiciary that like I said, many critics still see as being largely controlled by elements of the former regime. So that's the main reason for doing this. And again, his powers, which, you know, this decree that he issued on Thursday, which basically puts his decisions, makes his decisions immune from possible judicial challenges, you know, was there was a he did have a valid reason for it.
So yes, it's very important. Of course, I'm against all presidents and all presidential power grabs, but of course, there's always the seen and the unseen, and what's most important is not just president grabs power, it's who he grabs it from. And as you're saying, it's been, you know, the default power in the nation is the military. So pretty much anything he's doing, as you say, the court has been seen as a front for the military regime in the first place. It seems to me, seems like whatever he can do to limit the power of the military and take that power for himself and whoever he's claiming to represent, the Muslim Brotherhood or whatever other interests, seems like he could be picking a very serious fight, right? Doesn't he have to walk a very close tightrope? The military are, after all, the ones with the guns.
The military are the ones with the guns, but legally speaking, they've sort of been out of the picture. If you remember the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which played such a big role in the transitional, you know, which governed Egypt for 18 months following the revolution, has been officially out of power since, first of all, when Morsi won the election in late June. He assumed executive control. He assumed executive authority from the ruling council, and then sometime in August, he suddenly, if you remember this, he very abruptly dismissed the leaders of the military council, and basically ended military rule. And basically assumed legislative powers to himself, because the parliament, as I had mentioned earlier, had been dissolved earlier. So right now he does have judicial and legislative powers. The military does not technically have any power. Like you said, they do hold the guns, but legally
they hold
and constitutionally
the economy
speaking,
as well, don't they?
Sorry?
They control the economy of the country. All the major industries are owned by the military, correct?
I wouldn't say all major industries. I don't know exactly, and it's actually something that's quite hard to sort of get exact figures about, because it was shrouded in secrecy for so long under the Mubarak regime, to the extent that it was illegal for journalists and stuff here to write about the military in any way. So it's very difficult to know exactly how deep their tentacles extend into the economy here. It's hardly total. And I don't really think their influence over large swaths of the economy doesn't necessarily translate into political power.
Huh.
Like
so
I said,
minute,
right
now
technically they really do not have a political role to play, or at least they shouldn't, according to the Constitution and to the law.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the purge of the judiciary, or a purging of the judicial system from Mubarak era officials, has been a very long-standing demand of revolutionary forces. And what's interesting about Morsi's latest decree was that he also replaced the prosecutor, a very unpopular prosecutor general, who was also appointed by Mubarak in 1996. So this also has to do with purging the judiciary of Mubarak era officials. And what's interesting now is you have a lot of liberal and leftist forces who are Morsi's natural adversaries or rivals are now sort of in the same camp with the Mubarak loyalists against Morsi and against this latest decision. Again, a lot of these groups that had been calling to purge the judiciary for the last 18 months, they've been constantly calling to purge the judiciary and to get rid of this prosecutor general, are now actually against Morsi. And are now siding with Mubarak loyalists against his latest decision.
you're saying the leftists who've been pushing for the removal of the head prosecutor are now complaining now that he's been removed and they're siding with the former regimists against the Brotherhood. To what benefit?
I mean, I don't want to overstate that because I think a lot of liberal and leftist groups would be absolutely appalled to be, you know, to be accused of being sort of on the same side of Mubarak loyalists. But that is the case. I mean, they basically want a purge of the judiciary. They wanted the prosecutor general's removal, but they didn't want the president to be beyond judicial, you know, to have no judicial, to not right. be subject to judicial oversight, which is decree on Thursday basically states.
All right, but now, so tell me this. All the emergency laws have been repealed and all of that. Is it the case that the average Joe arrested in Cairo has a much better shot at a fair trial now? Is he certain to be free from torture, etc.?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I would say that he definitely stands a much better chance to be free from torture, as you said, only because there's so much, the police are so unpopular, and there's so much attention that's been put on the police. You know, the police are very much under the spotlight. And if any incident of torture does happen, it's seized on by, you know, by activists and by the media and made a much bigger thing of. Whereas under Mubarak, you know, this stuff would happen and nobody would know about it, you know, because the press was controlled and everything. So they really can't get away with that sort of behavior anymore. Although that being said, there have been reports of torture happening, you know, since Morsi has taken over. He's sort of taken some flack because there have been these reports of residual torture still happening at police stations. However, I have to qualify that by saying that he's worked very hard to try to replace. There are still elements of the old police force that are still around. I mean, the police force was so vast, you know, the Interior Ministry was so vast that it can't be expected that overnight, you know, the new administration would be able to purge all of these elements from these institutions. So stuff does happen. Stuff is definitely still bad stuff is still happening, but certainly not to the extent that it used to. And again, if it does happen, it gets a lot of media attention. You know, human rights groups and the media will jump on it immediately and make a big deal of it.
All right. Well, it sure sounds like you have a lot of pretty positive things to say about the results of the revolution so far. Not that everything's perfect, but I think when you and I talked, I don't know, let's say a year and a half ago or whatever, we were not so optimistic.
Right. Well, it's still far from. It's still quite difficult to be optimistic. There are two massive rival demonstrations planned for Cairo. Fortunately, they won't be happening in the same place. This has happened in the past, and has led to you know violence and clashes and that sort of thing. But two rival demonstrations have been planned for different districts of Cairo tomorrow. One of which will be attended mostly by liberal and leftist groups, along with Mubarak loyalists, and those will be people who will be demonstrating against Morsi's decree. And then there will be another rival rally that will happen elsewhere in Cairo, and that will be attended by Morsi's supporters, supporters of his decree. So a lot of people are just waiting and seeing to see how many people turn out. You know, it's sort of like an impromptu referendum. You know, the two rallies are sort of like will serve as an impromptu referendum to see which side sort of has more support. And I'm predicting that the pro-Morsi side is actually going to be able to field a lot more people than the anti-Morsi. These liberal and leftists and the anti-Morsi people do have a much louder voice than their political rivals. So it's easy to think that, you know, the country is divided in two, when in fact, you know, that the country is split in half over a particular issue, when in fact it's actually, you know, one side is actually much, much less representative than one might think from reading the media. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like one might think that half of Egypt are liberals and leftists, when in fact I would venture to guess that less than 10% of the total population could be classified that way.
Yeah. Well, now, so tell me a little bit more about this Morsi guy. I mean, is there a politician in the region or maybe in America that you would compare him to, who he reminds you of? Is he a Nouri al-Maliki type, or is he more like George W. Bush? Or are they the same?
Man, that's hard to say. I think it's still unknown. You know, I think it's still a big I think there's still a big question mark. He has done some questionable stuff. Two things that strike me as having been a little bit questionable is his acceptance of a loan. He's just negotiated almost five billion dollar loan from the IMF. Which is a bit questionable, considering what the IMF actually represents, and the other is his support for the revolution in Syria, which many people would argue is sort of part and parcel of the Zionist project in the Middle East. A lot of people would argue with that, but by basically coming out on the side of the Syrian revolution, he's coming out on the American access against Iran. Put it into that context.
Well, I mean, the American policy, let's turn it the other way around. The American policy is to support the Saudis, the Qataris, and their friends in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and in Syria.
Yeah, definitely. And the Muslim Brotherhood is very, very close to both Saudi and Qatar. I think more to the latter than the former. But yeah, that's true. Although that being said, I think it's quite interesting to see what just happened in Gaza and how we were all bracing here to see another caste-led like offensive. If you remember 2008, 2009, Israel's caste-led assault, which lasted for 21 days and killed 1,500 Palestinians. And during that time, Egypt kept its border with the Gaza Strip tightly sealed, didn't even allow injured people into the country to receive medical treatment. And that has contrasted sharply with Morsi's Egypt this time around, where they opened the border, they came out very strongly against Israel, and I think that had something to do with the fact that Israel stopped after 1 week, and that a ceasefire was agreed. I mean, the way Netanyahu was speaking, it sounded like he wasn't going to stop until they had assurances that Hamas was incapable of firing rockets at them, and that didn't happen. That didn't happen at all. They managed to hammer out the ceasefire, and Hamas and its missile firing ability remain intact, as you know. So I think there would have been a dramatically different outcome to this latest offensive if Mubarak was still around and not Morsi.
Right. Yeah, well, and at least it's got to be in theory from the point of view of the Israelis. They certainly, even if he really is as reliable as Mubarak, I guess they can't count on that as much as they were certain they could count on Mubarak, right? But again, what's Morsi going to do
about
it?
Right, they could certainly count on Mubarak to keep down the masses, you know what I'm saying? To prevent any popular demonstrations, again, you know, to just keep public opinion in place. Whereas now, post-revolution, you always have the possibility of 1 million, 2 million Egyptians suddenly hitting the street and making demands, whether those demands are, you know, have to do with a domestic political scene, or whether those demands happen to do with events in Palestine.
Yeah.
So
it's
dramatically changed the equation.
All right, now I know that Morsi got a lot of credit internationally for brokering the peace deal. Did he get a lot of credit domestically?
He did, but it was so quickly eclipsed by this declaration, you know. Some people suspect that maybe the timing of the declaration had to do with the ceasefire, and it was because of this newfound diplomatic clout, you know, that he had managed to achieve on the world stage because of the ceasefire, that he decided to do it when he did. But that, again, the exact reasons for why he did it now are still open to debate.
Interesting. All right, now, what were the popular demonstrations like during the Gaza war? I hate to call it a war because a war is when two armies are fighting, as the great Bill Hicks used to say. But during the late Turkey shoot, what was the mood like in Cairo? And is that where the demonstration started, or not until the power grab thing?
Well, no, it was kind of weird. It was very confused because you had some very weird stuff happening on the domestic front as well. You had this re-eruption of clashes in downtown Cairo on the now infamous Mohammed Mahmoud Street, if that rings a bell. It was the site of 4 days of clashes exactly 1 year ago, and you basically had a bunch of protesters going there to commemorate the clashes that happened last year when under the military council, dozens of people were gunned down. So you had people commemorating that about it just as the Gaza thing started. You had people going there to commemorate the 1 year anniversary of those clashes, and those ended up turning violent themselves. And those led to several days more days of running street battles between activists and police. And that coincided almost exactly with events in Gaza. So people were sort of leery about hitting the streets at that point because they didn't want to encourage the violence that was already going on. You know, I mean, the Islamists in general will only hit the streets as long as they with good reason, because they don't want any sort of instability. They don't want, they want to maintain maximum stability. That's the that's what Morsi is promising everybody, that he's here to bring political stability and that sort of thing. So the Gaza stuff was very muted, although there were very strong demands. The statements that were coming out of political parties across the board, and again, it's politically. You sort of have to, just because of the political climate here. If Israel starts beating up on Palestinians, you sort of have to, if you want to maintain any sort of political standing or your street credibility, you absolutely have to come out and condemn that sort of behavior. And everybody did, you know. But there were no massive demonstrations. I think there would have been if the fighting had continued, if the violence had continued and the death toll had mounted. You would have seen stuff, but like I said, Egypt was also very, very distracted by stuff that was going on domestically at the time. And I even wondered at the time if these weird clashes that I mentioned followed this 1 year anniversary, the Muhammad Mahmoud Street clashes. I almost wondered if there wasn't some kind of relation, if this wasn't some kind of attempt to sort of destabilize Egypt so it wouldn't be able to deal with what was happening in Gaza. And again, this latest round of clashes that I just mentioned. Weren't really supported by any political parties. It was weird. It was just this very weird, you had a lot of young activists who weren't affiliated with particular political parties. The authorities here said that several of them that were arrested confessed to having been paid to start trouble, to start throwing Molotov cocktails at police. So I mean, I don't know for sure, but I wonder if that was some kind of attempt to sort of destabilize the domestic situation. Like I said, so Egypt wouldn't be able to respond to events in Gaza. But again, it's very hard to tell. It's very hard to tell these days.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, Middle Eastern politics, man. It's a lot of factions fighting. Hard to keep track of who's interested in to do what all the time. It seems to me strange, Adam, that after all this time, the Rafah border is still pretty much closed. The people of Egypt, it seems like that would be one of the most obvious of their central demands, would be open this border, lift the siege, whether that's what Israel wants or not.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. People have been so focused on this latest decree and all of the, this huge showdown between the judiciary and the presidency that nobody's really focused on the border and the Gaza issue right now.
Well, that's
right
kind
now.
Of what
that's
I mean, is like
question.
All this time, I understand what you're saying about, they've been very distracted by these minor issues here in the most recent kind of short term, but it's been almost 2 years now.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, Gaza has always been at the forefront of I was always surprised that it didn't, that immediately after last year's revolution, they didn't open the thing. You know, the military council kept the border shut for the most part. It made some exceptions, but for the most part, it maintained the Mubarak era policy of keeping the border closed. Now, I know during the last, this last round of bloodletting in Gaza, these 7 days, I know the border was open. I know they were letting in a lot of medical stuff. I know a lot of activists who participated in convoys that went in there. As far as I know, they were allowing injured Palestinians to come in to seek treatment. What the final upshot, though, is whether things have sort of returned to the status quo in the days since, or whether there is a new policy regarding the border and whether it will be kept completely open, that's a very, very good question. Because what we're waiting for most of all is for what people want, certainly what the Brotherhood wants, what Hamas wants, what the people of Gaza want, is for the border to act as any other international border where you've got, where you can have commercial transactions going on. You can have big truckloads full of cement and building supplies just, coming in just as they would between two other, any other two countries. I don't know if that is the case yet. That's a very good question. I'll definitely find out for you.
Okay, good. Well, I'll keep calling you because you sure always know at least some kind of answer to my questions when I ask them. I really appreciate your time,
as
always,
Adam.
You know,
I do my best, but I got to say, Scott, it's really getting overwhelming with all of the stuff that's going on here. I mean, I've lived in Egypt for about 16 years, so I spent a long, you know, I had more than 10 years of living here under Mubarak, and things happened, you know, it was such a slow news cycle for so long because, you know, because nothing ever changed, whereas Egypt post-revolution, man, it's like every couple of days some incredible breaking, you know, some incredible new thing happens to some new incredible political showdown domestically, or there's some sort of, you know, some eruption, some regional problem that takes place it's quite overwhelming. I'll do my best to answer your question, Scott.
Hey, I think you're doing great, man. I think you're doing great. I hope people will go and take a look at ipsnews.net. The latest is Gaza assault shows a new Egypt. Thanks very much again, Adam.
Thanks, Scott. Talk to you again soon.
See
you. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Ben Franklin said, "Those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither." Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a playing card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com.